Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Taylor Kitsch. Taylor Kitsch has come a long way from cleaning the toilets on Bunsen Lake in British Columbia. And if it weren't for a knee injury that ended his dream of becoming a professional hockey player, he might never have graced our screens as the beloved Tim Riggins in Friday Night Lights, or as Murph in Lone Survivor, or David Koresh in Waco, or Dude in Airplane Bathroom in Snakes on a Plane. Despite not having a backup plan post-hockey, Taylor found his way into an acting class in New York City that changed his life, after his tough, no-nonsense acting teacher forced him to ditch the cocky attitude. It was through that process that Taylor discovered his love for acting and an appreciation for self-exploration. His acting career took off after an explosive audition with Peter Berg that earned him a role in Friday Night Lights. But Taylor acknowledges that success only comes with hard work and sacrifice. He says, "Just like when I was playing hockey, I was never the first line guy. I'm always grinding, always fighting." Taylor brought that work ethic to his most recent role as cult leader David Koresh in Waco, and the preparation was rigorous. In the months prior to filming, Taylor spent his time memorizing scripture, learning to sing and play guitar, and losing 30 pounds. He likes to dive deep and set the bar high, and his subsequent transformation is nothing short of astonishing. Taylor joins off camera to discuss the lengths he'll go to prepare for a role, why Friday Night Lights was so unique, why he almost dropped out of Waco, and he also reveals just how many snakes there were on that plane. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Taylor.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Oh,
finally, I'm a fan, so
well,
now we're doing it. We're actually here and we're doing it.
I know, and it's surprising to hear that because you were on my original list of people I wanted on the show.
What
when
happened?
We conceived this, I don't know.
Me either.
I think you're really busy.
Yeah.
And you don't have a publicist.
True.
Yeah.
True. Save a couple bucks a month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's more than a couple bucks.
Yeah, it
so
is.
So that's smart. But no, I seriously, when I first came up with the show, I mean, one of the early people I asked was Kyle, who never
yeah.
does this stuff.
Yeah.
But we had Michael B. on. We've had
awesome.
Connie Britton on. And I was a Friday Night Lights fan.
Hate her.
Yeah, she's
yeah.
terrible. She was rude.
Impersonable.
Yeah.
Just everything.
Yeah, just no manners. No, but you know, when Friday Night Lights came out, I was a new dad and a new husband. And I connected with the show. And then just watching your career, you know. Lone Survivor was incredible, and now you have Waco, which
yeah.
is an amazing piece of work.
Thanks.
But I would like to spend the majority of the time talking about maybe an underseen project that you did, and really nuanced performance, Snakes on a Plane.
Obviously. How that didn't just sweep the Oscars is beyond me.
I mean, you were in
Best
Snakes
Supporting,
on a Plane.
Best Picture. That
yeah.
was my first movie.
Was it really?
Yeah, David Ellis, who's passed actually since, but he was an amazing guy. And I play this surfer that's the
right.
first to die in the movie, which is claim to fame.
Well, using the Mile
yeah,
High Club.
Yeah, joining that, smoking a J in there. but he was just so great. And there's a crazy story actually, because I had 12 hours of makeup. First time ever doing anything like this. Yeah, because he gets bit so many times, they open the door
right.
and they fall out
right.
dead. And I was going to go do second unit where they pull the door open and reveal us being bit by, you know, 1,000 snakes.
Right.
And you obviously can't move because you're dead. And so no one told me and the gal this, but when we fall, all of a sudden there's buckets of real snakes being poured on over our bodies.
You're kidding. And they didn't tell you?
Didn't tell us.
You're kidding me.
And I have to be dead. So it was like, I freaked out, obviously.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wasn't playing dead anymore. I just started screaming. And then the guy who was the animal wrangler was like, oh, like tried to pacify the whole situation. It was just like, it's okay, they're not poisonous. And then Ellis came running over and was like, I'm so sorry, they should have told you, but it's like basically the snakes are like falling out of the ceiling onto you guys, and that's what the shot was. And I was like, good to know. But I'll never forget that. And I already hate snakes.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, you think about being a young actor, right? And you're in that situation.
You'll do anything.
You'll do anything. Yeah. Maybe there'll be
an
issue.
Those assholes. But can you imagine, though?
No.
It was, and so I'm, like, trying to plead to Ellis of, like, in this crazy makeup of, like, that was crazy, man. Like, I can't play dead when you're...
Could anyone play dead while having a bucket of snakes poured on them?
Better actors.
Maybe De Niro.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but, you know, also it brings up to mind, like, when you got that job, I'm assuming it would be, like, a major thing for you.
Yeah.
Like, did you have this instinct to go prepare somehow and, like, do your homework? And
I mean, I think I had, like, 5 lines.
Yeah.
Knew those. Killed those.
Yeah.
Was crazy nervous. Even a big thing for me was, like, going to the set and it wasn't a real airplane. Like, I couldn't imagine them having to move seats, and it was just, like, a quarter of the plane. And I was just like, this doesn't make sense, you know? Why aren't we shooting at the airport?
It's You're just like, those... the call sheet, this can't be right.
Yeah, totally. I just go to the airport.
Yeah. Where is everybody?
I remember, too, I think we were shooting FNL in Austin, obviously, and I got the cast to go to the premiere, or go to the screening when it hit theaters. And I was like, no, there's like a few other parts and this and that. And this was the first time I was like, I don't even know what scene I was cut out of. Like a tiny little scene, but it's a huge scene at the time.
Right.
And I was just,
it's
I was
one
like,
of two scenes.
Yeah, totally. I was a blip in the movie and I was like, oh my God, so embarrassed with the cast of FNL.
So Friday Night Lights was right after that.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I had, I sent a tape in the Texas Forever speech to Pete. On tape, I went and found some Texas beers, Lone Star beers, and had a sleeveless on and did the whole chug the beer, did the Texas Forever speech, and then getting the visa, he loved it. They actually asked me to read for Street first.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and I just gravitated towards Riggins.
Which was smart, because Street was out by the second
But ironically, season. I was told I was going to be like a fringe character and he could... come and go or whatnot. We're going to see how it plays or whatever.
Right.
So I didn't have high expectations with that, but it was an awesome process with Pete too. Once he saw the tape and then went and there's one guy left for Riggins and it was at Universal in the offices there. Finally get in there. Pete comes in the, oh no, I'm sitting in the round, this huge round table, couple Landry's, a couple Saracens, I think, and then one Riggins, and I'm sitting across from the other guy, and he's like, who you in for? I'm like, oh, Tim Riggins. And he's like, all right. And I'm like,
came on.
All right, cool. And then Pete came in. Everyone had their moment of improv with him, like 30 minutes.
Oh,
and
you
I,
had to improv
oh, yeah.
for the audition.
So 30 minutes one-on-one improv with Pete. And then
and was Pete playing Coach Taylor?
He was everything. He was my dad. He was doing ESPN interviews. He was a teacher. So he's coach.
So he was just throwing stuff
everything
out at you.
Everything you can think of.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Now, like, had you had any improv training at all?
Yeah, I did, actually. That's where I think like my strongest suit was because I love it. You know, I think you have to prepare a bit more to be grounded and be able to improv in character, too. So I could fly with that, especially Riggins. I mean, if I can't, if I have nothing going on in the brain, I could just shut down and it would be Riggins.
Right.
You
Good
know?
Point. Yeah.
So.
Right. But did you know that instinctually then? Like,
No.
Were you able to take those pauses or were you kind of like?
I definitely took my time.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially I think he just. With the lack of father and that, he just shuts down. And he kept bringing that up. So finally getting a reaction, which, you know, smartly he wanted out of me just to see if I could go there.
Go there with an explosive reaction.
Yeah, something big. And then we were walking down the hallway to the screen test, which is all the execs. It's all the ties in the room.
Again, crazy that you would be in a situation where there would be other people you were up against.
I know.
In the room. Like,
bizarre.
It's like the snakes on you when you're young.
Yeah.
It's just like there's no respect for that.
The process.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that gets more out of it. I don't know. It is a weird process.
Well, I suppose if you were at the place in your career where you had agents and managers, they just wouldn't allow that. right? When you're young.
Yeah,
like,
it's just a free-for-all, really.
Let's throw them all in a room and see who comes out alive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Truly. And then we're walking down the hall, and he's like, "You're just do what you did in the room with me one-on-one, and then we'll work on the Canadian accent, but just keep doing what you're doing."
Oh, really?
And then I get in the room, and he's like, "I'm going to play Jason Street in the scene." And then again, it's the Texas Forever scene, and I think one more. And he went off book and started like interrupting me while I was doing the speech, and I just ripped him in half and told him to shut up and stop interrupting me so I can get this out, and he loved it.
Really?
So yeah, then I went back, and then literally as I'm opening the door to the hotel room, the phone's ringing. It's like, "You got it." And I didn't even know where Texas was.
You're from Canada, yeah. Well, it brings up a question about like those early moments where you don't even know if this is going to be your career for a year or for 10 years.
Month even, if the pilot's going to get picked up.
Right.
And during this process, it would be like, "Hey, we're going to change networks. We're on a different time, different day, but we're probably canceled anyway. So don't stress about any of this."
Yeah,
that was like almost daily. I'm sure Chan said the same stuff, you know? But Pete really kind of just leveled the process, and no marks, no rehearsals. You know, it's just improv when you feel it's right, and fight for your character, fight for that integrity. And if you don't believe it's truth, then don't do it, you know? And that was like, I mean,
think about that. Think about how that sets the die for your career. That the first big job you get, you have the respect as a group of actors to make changes to the script, right? Or to
absolutely,
or to try new things.
It was that freedom, and that was super empowering.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was amazing. And Chandler, you got to tip the hat to them too, of him and Cons, just because they really knew how to prepare, and they would fight for what was right. And I remember Chan saying at the beginning that he didn't want to be that, make it a soapy relationship in that sense of like cheating on the wife or vice versa or whatever that was. He wanted that to be like the rock or the foundation of that whole environment. So I think that kind of set the precedent with everyone else kind of, you know, down the totem pole.
Yeah. Well, listen, one of the reasons I think I was drawn to the show is that was the husband I wanted to be, and that was the father I wanted to be, you know? And then there was a simplicity to his moral code.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you being sort of right at the beginning of your career, if he sort of took that role on to you as well.
It was definitely, I think the best leaders in any world are the ones that lead by their action and their work ethic, and he was that guy.
Right.
Beyond prepared, never took it for granted, but also had just a great time and could joke, and I learned or kind of sponged up as much as that as I could, you know? And I love throwing him curveballs. As, you know, Riggins could say anything.
Right.
He really could, and that was the beauty of him, you know? And
how long did it take for you to figure out, like, how much freedom you had with him, or what
early.
You could do. Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It seems like you came into that with a tremendous amount of confidence, given the fact that was such an early project for you.
I think it was more just being so raw and not giving a shit, like not knowing what a critic was, not really like caring, like genuinely, I didn't even fucking know there was going to be people writing about your performance. It was just like, I'm going to go in, swing, and this is how I want to do it, you know?
Right.
It was really that simple, and you kind of miss that now because you can get caught up in this and that and what it's going to mean and how much a box office represents if it's a good film or not, you know, which is shitty, you know? But just being in Austin, which is home now, I mean, that show has been just a springboard for the career and, I mean, your life, really, in a weird way.
What about Austin? Like, because Kyle moved there midway through the show as well.
Yeah.
I guess I'm curious about, like, for that show to be, to have such an influence on you that you would move to that town when, you know, 4 years earlier you didn't know what Texas was.
True.
You know?
I think it was just, one, I hate L.A. I'm not a huge fan of it. Hate strong, but I just can't live here. I don't know. I didn't want to live in New York. I'd studied there, and it was just kind of beat me up. And
So you studied acting in New York.
Yeah.
And okay, so back me up a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious about, you grew up in Canada, you were playing hockey, right?
Yeah.
When did the hockey dream die?
20, really.
Okay.
Yeah, your last year of junior hockey.
That's pretty late to be still in it.
Yeah.
Right? That's past
still
high
just school. Hanging on to that dream.
I mean, did you have a backup plan, or were you going to be a professional hockey player?
That was the mindset. And it wasn't like, one, I was trying to get a U.S. scholarship.
Okay.
Div 1 or 3 at that point. Because 20 is your last year that you can go. Usually, if you're really good, you're going at 17, 18. Late bloomer, I'd like to call it. So I was 20 and then having a decent year. But there was a lot of schools that were excited or whatnot. And then basically what happened in a nutshell, wrecked this guy, my MCL.
Okay.
And then recouped it with the BC Lions, their whole training staff. And then my first game back, it was just a freak accident again. When the play had died and you're going back to the bench and somebody just falls on your knee. And that was it.
Same knee.
Yeah, same knee. Oh. So, and then I asked my best friend to take me off the ice because that was kind of it. And that was like, it's art or life imitating art with like FNL. It was that level of just despair really at that time because there wasn't a contingency. There wasn't like a backup plan. This was what I was going to do.
And you were good enough that it wasn't a pipe dream. Like you could have
played. Yeah, I would at least go to school playing for another 4 years and hopefully take a swing in the minors somewhere. Or, I mean, it was still better than whatever else there was to me.
Right.
You're still living the dream. But then that was it, really. And then
you knew when the
second time, yeah, I was in the dressing room, wouldn't take my, it's so Friday Night Lights. I wouldn't take my gear off.
Really?
Yeah, just because I knew it was the last time.
Were you crying?
Yeah, I was gutted. Gutted. My mom was crying. She understood.
Oh, man.
And then that was it, really, for that. And then I would write these, no one knows this, but I would write these letters. All these schools, you know, you're after a game, you're getting interviewed by Div 1, Div 3 schools or whatnot. Here's a funny one, actually. We're in exhibition games, and they don't know your SAT scores yet.
Right.
And so I was playing well in the beginning of the year, exhibition or whatnot, and I'm going down the tunnel, and this Harvard scout pulls me over.
Right.
And he's just like, hey, man, great game, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, don't even fucking waste your time. Like, I'm not even like, I can't even cheat to get into your school. So we like literally had a great laugh and he's like, gives you the tap. And he's like, well, best of luck. You're a good player. And that was it. Yeah. So I was like,
but, don't even waste your time.
That's what I said to him. But then I would write like after it was all over, I didn't really have a plan. And in the summer, I would write these letters to, like, the Div 3 schools that were offering me full rides or, like, 80% scholarships, being like, hey, it's me. I know I threw my knee out, but it's good now. Do you guys have a room or can I come at least? At this point, I'm asking to be, you know, a walk-on with no scholarship or earn it or nothing. So
it was like desperation times.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Mourning and then desperation and then now what? And then
What do you do with the now what? Like if your whole life was you're one direction. Was the immediate concern I gotta get a job or
I got a job with the city, digging
with the city.
Yeah, with the city, weed whacking, digging ditches on a trail crew, on a road crew, and then on a grass crew. So you go around all the like sidewalks to
the medians.
Sounds
like the job you get when you're in jail. And it's community service.
Yeah, you're poking at trash with the orange.
Yeah, you got the thing
picker.
That picks.
Yeah,
yeah. The picker.
I did that before that, actually, at a lake. Bunsen Lake, it's called. And I went up the ranks. But my first year there was literally cleaning the shitters.
Well, what a crazy thing. A year earlier, you're having a conversation with a guy from Harvard in the tunnel.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't have any inkling that you'd be a performer or an actor when you were young?
No, I always loved it. Like, I always, like, won the speeches and, like, would love writing. And always was ahead of the curve in the writing. But terrible at math. Terrible. And then I literally think I was passed out of just pure pity at that point.
I'm starting here's to your, figure out why you made the character of Riggins so believable.
Yeah, right. Oh, man. So, but I was in like college English, which was ironic.
Because you could write.
Yeah, and I loved it. I loved stories. I love reading. I love all that. So, and then I love doing speeches in like grade 5, 6, 7, going to like the districts and or whatnot, winning your school, winning your class, your school, district, going to provincial stuff. Like, I love doing that.
Oh, wow.
And that's a bit of performing retrospect there.
Uh-huh. Well, sure, getting mostly, up in front of a live.
Yeah, and you're like, I was very animated and they're funny and like, just, it was fun. I loved it. Maybe those started to sneak in. It was like love drama in grade 10.
Yeah, but no idea of like, I'll go.
I had no idea it was possible.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. And I want to talk to you a little bit about this week's sponsor, Quip. When was the last time you really thought about your teeth? Well, Quip is thinking about your teeth, and they've come up with a great solution to keep them clean and healthy. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. And I can tell you from personal experience, it's great. It's light, it clips to your mirror, it's easy to travel with, and the toothpaste tastes good. So those are all things that make it lovely to brush your teeth. But here's the thing. Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of bulkier traditional electric brushes. And guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount of effortless. And here's the most amazing thing about Quip. Because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean. Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. I don't know about you, but I hate to have my toothbrush sitting out too long. And I'm one of those people that when I travel, I don't want to put my toothbrush back in the plastic case and bring it with me. I love the idea that there's a new brush head coming along all the time. And they've solved that problem by making it really affordable. And the free shipping part is just genius. It's just a simple, better way to brush your teeth. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. Find out for yourself why. Here are the details. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. That's spelled getquip.com/offcamera. And I'm telling you, this is a great product at a great price, and it's well worth checking it out. So please, check it out. We only have sponsors on this show that we believe in, we care about, and these guys are doing a good job. So take a look. And now, let's get back to the show.
So how do you go, okay, I'm just going to stop picking up trash and I'm going to go to New York?
Yeah, my mom tricked me into meeting this modeling agency.
She
tricked you? Yeah, she's like, oh, let's go for lunch downtown. And I'm like, that was a big deal going downtown for us. So I'm like, oh, okay, cool, we'll go shopping or something. And then I met him downtown. He's like, just take some pictures. It doesn't have to be crazy. And we'll send them to New York and we'll start, see if you can get some work here.
Right.
Good supplemental income. I was like, fuck you. I don't want to be a model. I'm good. And then he's like, starts throwing numbers out at you. And you're like, wow, that's a lot of.
That's better than $7 an hour.
Exactly. So I ended up like taking pics, doing that, getting picked up from a New York agency. And then my oldest brother was actually becoming a scientist at University of Lethbridge and doing all these crazy things there in the labs. And then he's got all the brains, obviously. And so I remember like doing the modeling thing not very well and then having that opportunity to go study there. And then I took that opportunity to go study at University of Lethbridge for like half a year, maybe a full year. Obviously, my grades weren't good enough to get into the university. So I did, I think, half a year of college, then got into the university. And then I was like, this isn't for me. And then that modeling thing was still there, still kind of this carrot just
right.
getting me out, you know?
And you could book gigs and have enough money to pay rent.
Yeah, barely. Right. I mean, I took crazy student loans. And, oh, yeah, I studied, I think, one semester of just macroeconomics and micro. I was just like, this is so ridiculous. Like, why?
You were drifting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then I started, then I went to New York, and then I was like, man, if I want to take this acting thing seriously, let me just see what this is about.
Right.
And at that point, when I moved and started studying, I was like, fuck, I can do this in a heartbeat. I don't even need classes.
Oh,
really?
I
was so cocky. Oh, yeah. She kicked me out of class because I was like, really cocky.
Oh, were you at like some solid acting
Yeah,
school
Sheila Gray. Oh, she was an amazing coach, and she's a hard ass in the best way. And, just beyond truthful.
Wait, so she kicked you out?
Yeah, kicked me out because she's like, you know what? This attitude of like, you know everything and what's going on. You really have no clue about yourself and what any of this self-exploration really means. So you can leave and come back in a month and we'll try this again.
And did you do that?
Yeah, I had no choice. But there was something that kept drawing me to it, no doubt. Like I absolutely loved it and would over-prepare if there's such a thing and would just immerse myself with whatever the homework was.
Was there an example of a moment that's burned into your brain where, you really felt like, oh, this is it. Like, I can do this.
Yeah, she does, like, these exercises, but it was a self-exploration exercise, and it was just like you're dealing with just shit in you that you don't even know you had in you, you know? It really does open up a lot of things of just like relaxing and just trying to get to know what makes you tick and what makes you not tick, just as importantly, and your own process,
right,
you know?
Right.
And that is everything when you need to start to prepare for something or whatnot. Now that I feel I have a really good sense of what I need to do to be successful or get to a Murphy or Carter or Koresh or whatever it is, you know, but that whole thing was 1,000 baby steps of trial and error and Friday Night Lights of being like, okay, well, that didn't work, you know, of like...
Was Friday Night Lights still an extension of school in some ways?
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. That was like, I couldn't have been more raw. And I think that's why a lot of people gravitate towards Riggins, you know, and the show. Like, we all were, except for Kyle and Connie, you know.
Right.
So they love that. And that makes them even more relatable and so forth.
Yeah, it's funny to think of the good fortune that you found this role where that rawness and that searching and the mistakes and the documentary style.
You were rewarded
style.
For the mistakes
right.
on this one.
Right.
And just like to have 3 years of that, 4 years of that was just, you know, huge. And to be off the grid and it wasn't getting crazy ratings. So you're not Riggins for the next 19 years and, you know, only Riggins for the rest of your career. You know, that was this little thing that we had in our little bubble just going and shooting, you know? It was Rogue as well. So it was just it was kind of like a master's class for 3 years.
You know? Yeah, and I would think that you come off that and you come on other sets and you're probably spoiled at that point by...
Oh, beyond.
Like, did you have to do some sort of... Is there an example of a comeuppance that you had?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yep. Wolverine, for sure. Just because it was like... I'm very instinctual. I've thought about this to no end.
Okay.
If it's a point or something, I want to play a scene a certain way. I'm always open to it, but I do feel like I've done my work and I've arced it out. But yeah, with you're dealing with a guy that came off Friday Night Lights and no marks, no rehearsal, nothing.
Right. We'll find you.
Yeah, totally. You want to go over there? You know, our DP Todd would just be like, sure. But yeah, you go on to, you know, you're in Australia and you're doing this crazy big movie.
Like Wolverine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think you just had a lot of different leaders on a set, you know, and I wasn't used to that. And you didn't have a lot of just one-on-one time with the director and it was just so many moving parts. And then all of a sudden it's just like, no, on this line, you need to be over here and your hand needs to be over here. And I'm like, yeah, right. You know, I'm like, no, you're crazy. I'm not doing that. And they're like, no, you need to do that. That's the shot. And it's like, what? or it's, you know, and then it gets into the creative, starts to spill, and then people you've never met are coming up to you and being like, you can't really do that. You got to just do it like normally and just kind of, and I'm like, hey, I'm Taylor.
nice
like
to
quite
meet you.
Literally, you know, but it was just like, that was the moment where I was like, man, you know, I literally sent an email out saying, I think I'm going to get fired.
Really?
Yeah, because I kind of
fought.
I had no
confidence?
Ground to stand on either. I'm like this guy on a show that no one's even playing the ninth lead on, you know, this crazy big movie. So you're expendable. I mean, I remember being in wardrobe. That was just a shit show. Like fighting.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder if what was going on through your head is, oh, crap, maybe I can act in Friday Night Lights, but maybe the rest of the thing isn't as joyful as I thought it was.
Yeah, no, the process wasn't, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And you are getting kind of beat up. And you are, yeah, look, you're a young actor, too, and you're working with Hugh Jackman, and you know what I mean?
You're one step up from snakes being poured on you.
Yeah, literally, right back to that.
Crossing
your fingers for that role again.
Yeah, did it feel like Friday Night Lights was this little oasis, and then you're back to...
It was. It really was. Yeah. Like, even with the rest of my career, it's just like it's something that, you know, it's just a process that just will never be emulated, and you remember it for that, you know, and that process. And but Pete still carries that with him. Like, I know shooting Lone or whatnot, you can still, you know, whatever you feel at the moment, and just tear into it, you know?
Well, and look, it brings up a point about the areas you can and can't control of your career, and saying yes or saying no to a film by trying to extrapolate what the experience is going to be like,
right.
I think is probably one of the hardest jobs you have. And, you know, this whole story about Waco where you play David Koresh,
mm-hmm.
you know, you've talked about how you almost pulled out of the project.
Yeah.
And I would think that that's the hardest thing to do is to know, okay, I'm going to commit 6 months to this, 8 months to this,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is.
Yeah.
Is this, you know, can I be an artist in this thing? Like, is that...
I think for me with Koresh, it was beyond fear, because fear, I love it. You know, I think it's, you have to go towards that. You have to react to it. And I really think in life too, it's like, it's how you react to that is gonna shape you in your direction. And with this though, I was 3 months in.
To the prep.
Yeah, 3 months of prep. Okay. Had dropped 25 at that point. And then every day you're reading about the end of days, abuse, 75 plus people burning alive, a tragedy, and then you're watching docs
on
it.
Multiple wives.
Yeah, everything.
Statutory rape.
All encompassing his abuse as a child, trying to rationalize that, trying to ground that, answering the whys, because there are some things that you'll never have answers to. Two, I can't comprehend, so I can't relate or connect to certain things, but that's my job, is to emotionally marry yourself to somebody in these circumstances and play in a grounding way and authentic as you can.
Right.
And so I was having a trouble with that, of trying to rationalize or trying to ground it for me, and I was just like, man, I know I made my bed, but this is like, I sent a note of just like, I don't know if I want to tell this story. It was just like, I guess, I think it is an amalgamation of that with lack of sleep and starting to get a little loopy. Because I'm in my 1,000-square-foot apartment in Austin every day, you know, doing voice work for singing, still haven't found Dave's voice. And then you're losing the weight, and then, you know, your guitar a couple hours a day at least, and then scripture and trying to figure Dave out. And it was just so much at a... And it's just you every day with all this. And I'm not playing the violin, it was just the process. And I think, retrospect now, I was ready, one, to go play him. But two, I didn't have an outlet yet. So I'm just assimilating all this shit every day. And then
and
I
you don't even
just,
have anyone to share it with or
not
talk
really,
about it with.
Not really. And that's one, I think, a catch-22 of Austin for me. As much as I love it, I don't have many people there that Chandler's one, but he's working, I'm gone or whatever, and that you can talk about the work. Like, I have amazing friends there, But I need, I think, a bit more of like more artists to at least bounce ideas off or whatnot. Or
yeah.
But I didn't have that really there for Koresh. And then I wrote this email kind of being like, hey, let's just, what would the repercussions be if I backed out?
If I just make this call, I can wake up tomorrow and I don't.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have to worry about this anymore.
I could burn my scripture books,
right.
Everything, all of it. But obviously it's like, I'm really proud and excited and that you got through it. And it was just really, the first day was a great day because it was, I went 2 weeks before. And Paul Sparks, who plays Steve Schneider, who I absolutely love and admire, and he's amazing. The first day with him was like, I think, one of the most cathartic for me through the whole process, because it was, we get in this little studio area and we're sitting down. He's got his binder, I've got my books, my backpack and all this, and we're so loaded with the knowledge of our take on it and what's going on and what this relationship is. I'm sleeping with his wife, who I impregnated her, and how do we want to tackle this to the end scene together, which was like crazy dialogue for months on end of how we're going to deal with Dave and Steve's death. And we're looking at autopsy reports and going through all this. But it was a beautiful experience because I had just had another guy that was kind of going through the same thing that I would.
Right.
We basically threw up all over each other.
Right.
Because it was just like, oh, this is, you highlighted the same thing in the script too, that that's a beat. You know, and
it's almost like, God, we should have called each other months ago.
Yeah, I know. But it's always like two like dogs walking around each other.
Right.
When you meet another actor, like that you're about to go on this crazy journey together that's like crazier than anything probably we've ever done, you know? And he doesn't know if I'm prepping at all.
There's probably an arc of confidence and insecurity throughout the prep where you lose the plot.
Oh, totally.
Right?
Totally.
I mean, is that part of the process?
Yeah. And redirecting yourself. I mean, you got a guy that memorized the Bible. I mean, if you plop, you know, the Bible in front of me, it would just be ridiculous to be like, all right, page one, here we go. You know, it's like you have to get a bit more myopic than just like going through the thousands of pages.
I mean, do you think it comes from the fact that there's a voice in your head saying you're not good enough, so you have
totally.
To be good enough?
Fear of failure, I think. And I only know how to grind. You know, I don't go into this going, oh, it's going to be good. I'm just going to do this. I'm going to kill it. No, this is like, how the fuck am I going to get this? And to the bar that we have it at our head, too, because that's sometimes unreachable. But I'll definitely spend the time and preparation to try and get there. So I think it's all encompassing of that. And just, again, it's that pressure you put on yourself. And like, I wasn't, again, it's like even playing pro hockey. Yeah, I would have played, but I wouldn't have been, you know, the captain of the LA Kings or made the LA Kings. You know, I would have grinded to even just be in a bubble, like to try and even get there. So that's all I really know, you know? So,
right.
You know, the being homeless in LA or being homeless in New York, like that was just like, this is what you do.
It's you were like, homeless in both places while you're working.
Yeah, but now it's like, and at the time I'm not like, oh, where's my violin? Poor me, I'm homeless. It was just like, oh, I ran out of money. I'm going to bug a buddy and sleep on his couch or I'm going
to hustler mentality.
I'll sleep here.
Yeah, I'll figure it out.
Because I didn't have a contingency. And that's a big thing for guys now. I think, one, with all the social media and everything's in the now, I think we're getting a bit lazier and we don't want to put the work in as much. And they want the end result before you even understand the process to get there. I see it a lot where there is an under preparation going on with some people that you work with that, you know what I mean? Where
yeah.
It's just like they expect it to be there, but it can't get there unless you sacrifice and put the time in. So I truly believe I'm where I'm at because of just sacrifice and putting the time in. Even in like playing hockey, it was like, I was never the first line guy. I literally would fight to stay on teams. And whatever it was, maybe being the youngest kid of two older brothers, just grinding, always just fighting.
Yeah, it's funny.
You know?
Like, I wonder how your approach to acting would be if you were the first line hockey player that blew out your knee, that you were sort of always the guy with all the talent.
I wouldn't be here.
I wonder if you'd prep for stuff as much. Or
I wouldn't. I don't think I would.
So
because
like
the worst
deep.
Feeling in the fucking world is if I went after Koresh or Mike Murphy, or especially these guys that have lived and left a legacy, it's like if I had rapped, you know, check the gates, you're done, you've wrapped the movie, you get the applause at the end from the crew.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, if I had just played guitar a bit longer, I was too scared to get singing lessons. I should have got singing lessons. Or if I had done, if I had studied the scripture, or if I lost 10 more pounds, I would have been closer to his look. I would just, I couldn't live with myself.
But think about that theory, because what you're describing is like, it's that Schindler's List thing of if I could have done so, I could have done more, I could have done more. And it's like wherever you set the bar, then you go, oh, I reached the bar, I could have set it higher.
Mm-hmm.
So, I understand it, but at the same time, like, that's a tough way to live.
It is.
You know, I read that you're playing 3 or 4 hours of guitar a day and studying the scripture and losing a bunch of weight. It seems like you're a guy who wants to live in the skin of his characters.
Yeah.
What does that do for you and for the character?
I think it just brings you closer to him, or at least I trick my brain, and that's all we're doing as well. But I think it just brings you closer to who he was. He was a great guitarist, so it's like I'll try and get good enough to... One, it's gutting if I am on set and we have to bring someone in to do a close-up. That's just, to me, as a lead and leading by example on a set, playing a Koresh. It's like, okay, guys, no, I didn't study this at all. Here's your guitar, and let's get the insert, and then I'll start playing again.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the way I want to do it, you know? And if I have the time, then there's no excuses why you shouldn't. Like, what the fuck else are you doing? This is your profession.
I understand that. Yeah, you know? I understand that. Did you memorize the whole Bible?
Yes. But it goes to, like, we were talking earlier about photography. It's like, man, I have time to study photography now, and this is something that's given so much back to me because I love it so much.
You get to live other people's lives.
Yeah.
And not as in a surfacey way.
Yeah.
You get to go all the way in.
Yeah, and I get to pick up these attributes that I wish I had maybe earlier, like the guitar. Like, I still play every day and it's given me music, you know, and I'm still not great, but by the time in 4 or 5 years I'll be able to play music, you know. Or I mean, photography's been an incredible outlet for me when I'm not working, you know, going on these trips. And you know,
I think I love that's what I envy about actors. I think this idea that you have an excuse to get totally obsessive about something that isn't directly related to your own life.
Yeah.
But somehow there's a financial justification to going and playing guitar for 4 hours a day.
Yeah. It is amazing. I mean, there's silly ones as well of like I can rip a bow staff across the room, you know, or sword work or playing cards or whatever those are, you know. I never held a gun growing up, and you hand me an M4 rifle, I could just gut it and put it back together again after loan, you know? I could blindfold it upside down, we're shooting live fire, and it's just like, those kind of things are, you know, incredible things. You know, you're getting trained by magicians, Navy SEALs.
Right.
Like, it's incredible.
Yes, not only do you get obsessed with something, you get to bring in the master to show you how to do it.
You know?
I mean, what an amazing life.
It's
awesome. And it does seem like you're drawn to the difficult roles. I mean, combat photographer, Navy SEAL, firefighter. Like, you seem to gravitate towards the things that require a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know
I don't think you're doing enough if you're not. You know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe that's a validation within me that, like, I feel I need to just give up something or, like...
Like a sacrifice.
Yeah, like, push yourself. Because then I find myself, if I can, I find myself more rooted that I know I've put in the work to get to Murph or Koresh or whoever it is, you know?
Right.
Because if you ever go on a set and you're ungrounded, watch out. You know?
Give me an example.
You know, Leguizamo was awesome in Waco. And he's just a pro, and he can really turn it on, and in between takes, he can just take a breath and joke around. And whatnot. But he came onto this set, and we had been shooting, and we're all like in our, we're swinging. And he's like, oh, man, you can't come to this set on prep. You'll be eaten alive. You know, and I just took so much pride in that because everyone on that set was just like there to, with such a purpose, and we're so rooted and grounded that he's like, no, this is about the work right now. And I think he really loved that. But yeah, the whole set dictated like the pace and the tone. Like my first day, I think, I don't know if it was on point, like they wanted to like see what I was doing with Dave, because I was offered it and they never really, you know, we had a table read, which is the worst fucking thing on the planet. You ever meet an actor that's like, oh, I love table reads. They're liars. I hate them. You're going through a whole fucking arc of emotion or an episode of like Waco, like use episode 3 where it's like crazy. It's a 15-minute shootout.
Right, how do you sit at a table and do that?
You're crying, you're yelling, you're calm, you're screaming, you're giving psalms to a dead man, and you're just sitting there with your script, and you're like, Dave walks into a room, man taking his last breath. He had been shot 4 times. He comes, brings in a psalm. And then you like give this psalm, and you're like sitting there, and you're just like, this is ridiculous. This is not how it's going to be. I'm not even near like where I need to be in any state. So if the bar was here, put it under your boot and fucking stomp on it. Because it's just, to me, it just,
it's just, not what you do.
There's no accuracy whatsoever. And that's why, ironically, like, if you go, you know, audition for a role, it's like, oh, here's a script, and can you come in? Savages was a good example. Because it was like, oh, here's Savages. They love you for it. Between you and a couple other guys, can you go and, you know, read for it? I'm like, mate, I need time. Like, I can't, like, it's Monday and you want me in the room with Oliver Stone on Thursday to create a character and go in there and this is who the character's going to be? This is ridiculous, you know? Because I don't know who Chan is yet. And so I just kept begging for weeks on end. And they weren't happy with it, but it got me the role. You know, it helped immensely.
God, that's so interesting. It's like once you know how to do your job, you can't. The audition process doesn't even make sense anymore.
To me, it doesn't.
Yeah, you know, one thing I was really drawn to about Waco, right from the start, was here you are playing a character that he's a leader, and and the one thing every one of these guys has in common, whether you call them a cult figure or a crackpot or whatever it is, they have charisma. Yeah. And I think in that first episode, you're speaking to your entire congregation. Mm-hmm. I couldn't help look at that and go, okay, you've spent a career downplaying your charisma in a lot of ways. I think Riggins downplayed his charisma, and obviously in Lone Survivor and in Only the Brave, there's not those scenes where you are, you know.
Just chew it up. Yeah.
And then here's this opportunity to do it. And I wondered about that. What it was like to do that with the other actors in the room and have to, like, did you use them like a live audience and connect with them?
Oh, yeah. That was first day shooting, believe it or not. And that goes back to setting that tone, I think. And I don't know if they thought that out, but it was brilliant. And I had ran that, God, 600, who knows how many times. When you're running, when you're on your motorcycle, when you're it was, so I knew it inside out.
Was that the big,
and I was shaking,
like,
I was fear so
moment?
Nervous.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Really?
So we did it without anybody in the room, just for camera, and I was shaking, and my voice wasn't grounded yet, because I was nervous. And I knew this was a 7, 8, 9 page thing, and just a huge beat.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I'm working with the actors, really. But it's such a different thing when you're just you. And then now this is the first time with the crew that's seen me as Dave in this sermon. And there's a bunch of little scenes, but you couldn't really get a good full feel of Dave in the scenes before, or the crew hadn't. And so this one I was like shaking, and it was just like just a real moment of just, I guess, in character, just being like, here we go, you know?
And then when you got the audience in the room.
Oh, that was awesome.
Well, yeah, tell me, like, was there a point when it switched from nervousness
to full on ownership? Yeah.
And it happened right there.
Yeah, because the rehearsal, you're shaking, but you get it out. You know, you're like, ugh, okay, good, now let's go. Because it's not a matter of knowing the material anymore. It's just a matter of how far we want to push it and where we want to go. And then once I got, you know, 90 plus people in there, then I was like, that's my personality too. I'm just like, no, you're going to kill this now. You prepped and you're ready. So here we go. So I loved it. We did like two takes, and John and Drew Dowdle came out and they were like, what the fuck? This is crazy. This is unreal. This is like, we got it. I mean, we got it. So do you want to like do any more? Like, what do you want to? And I'm like, yeah, let's go. Let's go. Like, maybe I'm going to go in here and do something like fucking nuts or something. I don't know. Let's try something. He's like, all right, awesome. And they scurry back behind Video Village, you know? And then I'd go crush through the doors and just go at it, you know, and really call guys out. Or
Have you done a lot of scenes where you're in front of a lot of people? I can't think of scenes like that.
No, me neither. Not like that, that's for sure. And this was like a great note, simple note that John had was like, and we still laugh about it. It was like Dave Koresh's birthday every day before the first siege, the first 50-minute gunfight. Because if you think about it, he comes from this environment that's like lacks control, abuse, 14-year-old mom. He left when he was 14, memorized the Bible by 16, 17, all that. And then he changes his name, studies scripture, grounds himself in that, finds a purpose, and he creates this environment of an elitist, of control, manipulation, and purpose for both. If he doesn't have people to hear his message, he's got nothing either, you know? So before the first siege, it's good to be Dave Koresh.
In general, that role is probably the biggest extrovert you've played, right?
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
By far.
God. Well, obviously, the thing that is maybe really obvious to actors, but maybe not so obvious to people who have never done it, is this idea that you can't really play a character and judge them at the same time. You can't also be sitting there
going...
I'm like
thinking in my head to interrupt. I'm like, how do you know this?
I've been sitting there having these conversations.
As well.
Believe me, if you would come on the first season, I may not have known that.
Totally.
But to take on a character like David Koresh and figure out a way to not only not judge him, but also play him with enough love and enough empathy that you can get an audience to go, oh, I understand that guy. I kind of like him too. And I guess I'm just asking if that's something you have to kind of keep telling yourself or if that's something that you have to figure out how to get past.
It was, I mean, that's quite literally the process, especially at the beginning. And there's things I can't correlate myself to with him that he'd done and his beliefs, the end of days, the women, the kids, whatever it is. And it's just like, I couldn't get past it. And I think that just hindered my process of opening all these other doors to who he was.
You were judging him.
Yeah, especially early. And I was guilty of listening to other people's views on him that weren't educated on who he was or had come out of it and listened to or read a headline and made a decision on who he was. Or, again, you saw a bit of press during the 93 event and all the sensationalism.
Sure.
Like, there was like, if you put his picture up next to Manson's, what's your impression going to be? And if that's the only thing you remember seeing... I was guilty of letting those things filter into my impression.
Right.
And so it was like, it sounds like a bit cheesy, but another great actor friend of mine who had played some pretty diabolical people of just, he's like, did he not love? Did he not cry? Did he not have any of these other emotions? I mean, we know that's there. So now it's your turn to like figure out why he does what he does, but also like, that's the beauty of this whole, of who he is, of any of these guys you get to play, is like, let's go explore this part, you know, because no one knows. You don't know it yet, but it's like, this part of him is who he is, just as much as the other, you know, that relatability or whatnot. A lot of these guys that have these pasts or these lack that upbringing do come from abuse, do come from a lack of control, and hence the environment he created. And I really latched onto that, and that helped me. But I think I never go into a scene being like, oh, I hope you're empathetic to Dave in this. It's like, no, this is who he was. It's like that allows me to just go as authentic as I can.
Well, I got to ask, when you've done everything you can, and you talk about that idea of after the crew applauds you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have the feeling that you have done everything you can. Are you then able to divorce yourself from the results?
It's easier.
Critical or box office or whatever it is.
It's easier.
Yeah.
I still think you care. It's like if you feel you've taken this beautiful picture and it took you a journey, a week to get to this one spot, and you got there and the sun was right and the light was right and you take it and say it took you months to get to that and you planned it out and whatever it was and you got it and it means something to you, and then all of a sudden you expose it and people are like, oh, what else you take? What else you do on that trip? Or it's like, oh, that's good. What? I mean, it's okay. And then there's a few that are like, oh, it's a pile of shit. What happened? You know, it's like, obviously you care.
You just described your experience of
my career.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that's why what you choose is so important, because you got to live it and do that. And you should end up caring about it no matter what it is, you know. And you want your stories to be seen, or you want your song that you wrote and gutted yourself out to people to relate to. And hopefully that takes them to a journey that maybe you went on writing it, or,
yeah,
you know. So I think it is personal. But there's also, when you do everything in your power, it allows you to let go of it a lot more. You know, for sure, there's a lot of people up top making business decisions as well of what's going to hit, what's not.
And you have no control over
it. None.
Yeah.
So that's that trust that's on set with the director. But yeah, that's a tough, for sure.
I think that's the challenge. I mean, obviously you've had a long career at this point. And the challenge is how do you maintain your love for it and maintain this idea that you want to risk it? And you do want to have these experiences where you're in your 1,000-square-foot place,
yeah,
in Austin for 3 months working on this part.
Yeah.
And you don't want it to be an indifferent reaction at the end.
No.
Well, look, it's obvious you take what you do very seriously, and the results are you're building this career that hopefully continues on this path where you do get to embody these characters that connect with people in strange ways. And
yeah.
But I think that you said it best. I think the idea that you can go on into other people's lives through immense hard work and study and deep diving into what they did, I mean, that's got to be the greatest reward of your art.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that, you know, if you're not having a crisis of confidence,
right,
you're probably not doing something right.
I agree.
But God, it's fascinating to talk to you.
Likewise, and thank you for finally having me on. I've been trying to get on for years, and you kept saying no, and you're not good enough, and
that's
all
that. So. Yeah, you knocked the door a couple times.
Yeah,
we're like,
yeah.
Pretend we're not here.
With food,
Taylor's
coffee,
here, yeah.
Cash, all of it.
Listen, we wouldn't have a show if if it was as hard to, you know, get every guest on as it has been to get you. But no, thank you for doing it.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to talk about myself for an hour plus. Anytime, I'm open to that.
Thanks.
And we'll go for a ride, hopefully.
Let's do it. Let's go motorcycle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, talking is fine, but
yeah, riding's.
All right. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey folks, that's our show for this time. It was great to finally have Taylor on off camera and get to know him a little bit. If you want to know his work better, start with Waco and then check out Friday Night Lights, Lone Survivor, The Bang Bang Club, The Normal Heart, and Season 2 of True Detective. And if you want to know off camera better, check out our website, offcamera.com. In addition to being a podcast, we are a television show and a magazine. You can see Off Camera on DirecTV's Audience Network or by signing up for a monthly subscription. For $4.99 a month, you can access every episode in our archive on any device, anytime. That's over 135 hours of creative conversations with iconic actors, directors, musicians, and artists. all filmed in glorious 4K black and white. So check that out on our website. Another way to go deeper into the off-camera experience is our magazine. We create an issue for each guest that comes on the show, filled with our long-form conversation and exclusive photographs. You can buy one magazine or a subscription and get your weekly dose of off-camera in print form. It's a great way to support the show. So check that out in the store. There's also some special items like signed editions and t-shirts and our latest coffee table book, Off-Camera, The Portraits. The book makes a great gift, and it's filled with intimate, never-before-seen photographs of all of the artists that have appeared on off-camera. Another great way to support the show and be part of the conversation is through social media. In fact, we would love it if you didn't keep off-camera a secret. If you're liking what you're hearing, tell the world. Whether you have 3 followers or 3 million, don't they deserve to know about our little show? I think so. In fact, if you could take a moment in the next few days and digitally shout about us, we will pick a few lucky listeners and send out an off-camera care package. We are Off Camera Show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. Also, if you want to send me an email, I am sam@offcamera.com. As you can guess, putting together a show each week is not easy. And I feel very lucky to have our dedicated and hardworking crew helping make Off Camera a reality. A big thank you to Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, Amy Jones, and Matt One Ball Davidson. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with writer and show creator Jason Kadams, who has been making me cry for over 10 years with his shows Friday Night Lights, Parenthood, and now Rise.
After I read the book, I got to go meet him, the real Lou. And I gave him a copy of the pilot script. And then after he read it, he just started to tell me all the things that he loved about it. It was so moving. I'm actually getting moved now, even thinking about it, because I was seeing the gift that he had with all these kids. And the gift was that he saw them, how he could see the beauty in them. And I could see it because he was doing it with me.
Jason got his start on My So-Called Life and has turned personal stories about relationships and families on network television into an art form. His dedication to his craft, willingness to share his own personal struggles, and desire to champion often underrepresented groups in his storytelling make him an artist whose work I always look forward to watching, even if I blow my Kleenex budget by episode 3. See you next time, off camera.